Eggs are bad? No, eggs are good. Bacon is good? No, bacon is bad. Bread is bad? No, bread is good. Butter is good? No, butter is bad. We've been given a lot of good advice as to what is good to eat, and yet we continue to eat ourselves into big trouble. And so today we pause to ask, who is responsible for talking us into this obesity epidemic?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1040th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there on the along the shores of the Subic Bay who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Jason, hello.
My pleasure, sir.
Jason, a quick question for you.
Fire.
Is butter good? Or is butter bad?
I think butter is good.
You think butter is good?
Oh, yeah.
Also with us today, we have intern producer Dylan. Dylan, what do you think? Is bacon good or is bacon bad?
Health-wise, I'm sure bacon's probably not the best.
Not the best.
But bacon is amazing, so I would much rather live a shorter life with bacon than a longer life without it.
As would a lot of people, I think. Well, folks, we've been given a lot of advice over the years as to which foods are good to eat and which ones are not so good to eat. Just this week, as a matter of fact, the federal government is releasing its once every 5 years new dietary guidelines for Americans recommendations. But it seems like the more advice we get, the more confused we become. Eggs are bad. No, eggs are good. Bacon is good? No, bacon is bad. Bread is bad? No, bread is good. Butter is good? No, butter is bad. As a consequence of our confusion, we've been eating ourselves into a monumental obesity crisis with over a third of us now breaking the scales upon which we stand. So today we pause to ask, why are there so many conflicting opinions about which foods are good to eat? Who's responsible for talking us into this obesity epidemic? And where can we go to find objective food and nutrition science? Well, here to help us consider food and diet, we have Laura McCleary, who is the Regulatory Affairs Director for the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Laura, welcome to the Food Chain.
Well, thank you so much.
Good to have you aboard. You're in D.C.?
Yes, I am.
It's a good place for the Center for Science in the Public Interest to be, is in D.C. So what is the CSPI?
We're a nonprofit advocacy organization. We publish Nutrition Action Health Newsletter, which goes out to 800,000 subscribers.
Wow.
And we work for nutrition and pro-public health changes in Washington.
And you are the Regulatory Affairs Director. Does that mean you go around from office to office in Washington, D.C. and kick some butt?
That's what I try to do.
Well, there's a lot of it to kick back there, so good luck on that. We always ask, Laura, who pays the way for CSPI?
So it's paid for by our members, who are the subscribers to our newsletter, and by foundations that have an interest in public health. We do not take any money from the government or from corporations.
Good. So essentially, you're representing consumers then.
That's the idea.
Well, it's nice to know somebody's out there representing us for a change. Well, I'd like to start with this whole notion of conflicting opinions. And the reason I think that I picked up on the subjects that I got a press release from you, your organization, CSPI, about the Snackwell effect. And I remember Snackwell cookies. And I never did try one, but I was always amazed that we actually went to the trouble of inventing one. And I think we did because in the 1980s and 90s, the USDA's dietary guidelines told Americans, we're getting too fat, so you got to quit eating fat. What happened?
Well, that's right. There was a brief period where there was a sort of low-fat craze, and companies rushed to fill the new consumer appetite for lower fat foods by inventing bad ideas like Snackwell cookies that were high in sugar and didn't offer much nutrient value.
So the interesting thing about Snackwells, as I remember it, is that they had fatless fat or artificial fat, or Nabisco actually invented a fat that wasn't a fat or something like that. Am I right?
Well, there was Olestra, which was supposed to take the place of fat in the diet, but which gave people lots of unpleasant gastrointestinal side effects. And so that's really a niche product today. It more or less got relegated to the back of the chip aisle. You know, the truth is the low-fat craze didn't last that long. And if you remember, it was followed by a low-carbohydrate craze.
But wait a minute. It seems like I still see low-fat things on the grocery shelf whenever I walk down the aisles. It says low-fat, low-fat, low-fat.
Well, that's right. It's certainly alive and well as a claim for a product. And there are plenty of consumers that still try to lower their fat intake, and that's good dietary advice. Overall, Americans eat way too much dietary fat, as the Dietary Guidelines report put out this week indicates, and we could all do with lowering the amount of saturated fat in particular in our diet. So, you know, low-fat foods like low-fat milk are part of a healthy eating pattern and something that remains an important part of dietary good advice.
Mm-hmm. So as a consequence of eating less fat or going from a low-fat or a no-fat or whatever diet, we started doing what?
Well, there's a story that's out there. It's a narrative that says that we all got fatter from this low-fat advice. And what we did is look into the data on this. And there's, you know, some circumstantial evidence. The idea is the obesity epidemic took off and got much worse at the same time that we were all told to eat less fat. But when you look at the amount of change in the American diet, what you see is that, in fact, we didn't eat less fat, even though there was a kind of low-fat trend that was hitting the grocery stores. The dietary fat, basically, the amount we consume, basically stayed the same over the 1980s and 1990s and has continued to exceed the amount recommended by sound nutrition advice throughout that period and through today. So, you know, we didn't really follow the low-fat advice. And in fact, we did eat more sugar and more refined carbohydrates in the form of bagels and bread, that is non-whole grain bread, and pizza and buns and that kind of thing. And so when you add more sugar and empty calories in the form of white bread on top of not lowering our fat intake, that really is what accounts for the obesity epidemic. Not that we all followed dietary advice, but in fact that we really didn't.
So, but we're still stuck with this whole notion of, well, eggs are good, no eggs are bad. Bread is good, no bread is bad. And on and on and on and on. Fats are good, no fats are bad. So it seems like still there was a lot of conflicting advice out there in the world.
Well, let's take that on. On eggs, what the dietary guidelines that just came out this week says is that dietary cholesterol, which is high in eggs, remains a health concern. And while the evidence isn't strong enough to form a solid dietary recommendation, there's enough evidence out there that shows that cholesterol is a concern, that individuals should really eat as little dietary cholesterol as possible. It also says that egg yolks or egg whites can be part of a healthy diet and can help meet the protein recommendations for the healthy eating pattern. So that a very moderate consumption of eggs might fit into a healthy diet if your overall levels of calories and protein mm-hmm. are minimal and you're reducing dietary cholesterol from fat, that is high cholesterol oils, accordingly. So, you know, the problem with nutrition advice is that it's complex and you're trying to give advice that maps onto the way people actually eat. And the truth is, on eggs, it's sort of a mixed picture.
So it is kind of confusing then, isn't it? I mean, in just listening to you, I heard that, yeah, eggs are bad, but yes, eggs can be good. And so the consumer, dumb me here, is listening to this from somebody from the Centers for Science in the Public Interest, which is a consumer, it's for me. And I'm going, I'm not quite sure I understand that. But...
We're
going to take a quick break, Laura, but we'll leave us in confusion. And when we get back, you'll make us unconfused. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Laura McCleary, who is with the Regulatory Affairs Director for the Center for Science in the Public Interest. We're talking about the dietary advice given us by everybody and why it's so confusing and where can we find some real information. Do stay tuned. Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city greenbelts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5, 6, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're talking about what we eat and why what we eat, it can be so confusing. Confusing to the extent that we have eaten ourselves into an obesity epidemic, but in which about 30% of us, about a third of the population, is now obese. Who talked us into this obesity epidemic? Was it the government? Was it the food industry? Or did we talk ourselves into it? That's the question on the table today. And you're invited to participate out there, 831-479-1080. We have Laura McCleary, who's with Center for the Science and Public Interest. She is a regulatory affairs director, which means she goes through the halls of Congress kicking butt, taking names. And, the feds, this week, they came out with last year's five-year plan, five-year dietary recommendations. Laura, what are they telling us to do this time?
Well, right. They say, consistent with what they've said for the last more or less 30 years, to eat more fruits and vegetables, that none of us eat enough of those, to eat more whole grains, to consume fat-free or low-fat dairy like milk, yogurt, and cheese, and to eat a variety of protein foods, including seafood, fish, lean meat, poultry, eggs, beans, nuts, and seeds. And then to eat some healthy oils, so oils like canola and vegetable oil, and not like coconut, which has a lot of saturated fat. And so then they say limit saturated fat, added sugar, and salt.
What is the difference between... let's take fats, I guess, because that takes us right back to the original conflict here. Some say that we should, well, not to go back to this whole notion of eliminating all fats, but, you know, you look at milk, for example. There's raw milk, whole raw milk, that contains a whole bunch of fat. There's pasteurized milk and there's pasteurized low fat. There's pasteurized no fat. Which milk should we be drinking?
Well, we don't think raw milk is safe for consumers given the risk of bacterial contamination. So we think you should be drinking pasteurized low fat milk or 2% milk if you must. And that's just because it's easier to fit within your total calories, if you minimize the fat in milk. And it still provides most of the nutrients that you're getting from milk consumption.
So this would be a recommendation in direct opposition to those of the Weston A. Price Foundation, which recommends raw milk.
That's right. We disagree with less than a price.
Okay, so there we have a fundamental difference between two consumer organizations, both of which are looking out for the best interests of we consumers. Which one should we believe, the Weston A. Price Foundation or the Center for the Sciences in the Public Interest?
Well, I obviously have a point of view here, but I think that the data show that raw milk can be a potent source of contamination and a dietary risk, and there's just no reason to subject consumers, or and particularly children, to the risk of life-threatening contamination from raw milk. So that's the position of our organization.
Fair enough. The 2015 Dietary Guidelines for Americans, as you say, is the same as has been promulgated for the last 30 years, which means six dietary guidelines because they're 5 years in a piece. So going back six of these, they've all said pretty much the same thing then.
They've all said that we generally eat too few fruits and vegetables and too much fat and sugar. And that the emphasis in grains should be on whole grains, and that lean proteins are preferable to fatty or sources of protein like red and processed meat. So that's been a general good and consistent set of dietary guidelines for the whole time that the guidelines have been developed by government nutrition scientists. And, you know, we think obviously there are a lot of sources of alternative information out there that consumers may pay attention to. But one thing to know about these dietary guidelines is that these are developed by a panel of scientists after public input in a 2-year process, and they're based on the best science. That is science that's actually objective and developed through dietary trials and observational studies of how people eat and what diseases result from those. And so, you know, we think these are the most scientific set of guidance that's available.
Mm-hmm. Now, are these panels that the government puts together subject to the same kind of lobbying that all the rest of the government is subject to as well?
Well, the participants are carefully vetted for conflicts of interest, and they're subject to the government standards for addressing those kinds of conflicts of interest and disclosure of those sort of conflicts of interest. So that's one protection. They tend to be academics from universities and scientists with multiple credentials. So it's another level of protection. But the public process for input includes a wide range of stakeholders. So the food industry can go and testify and submit comments to the official docket for this process in the same way that public health and members of the interested public and consumer organizations like mine can participate.
Now, we've seen a lot of complaints with respect to the 2015 dietary guidelines from non-governmental organizations, I think perhaps yours as well, that complain about the fact that the government did not come down on red meat. They allowed for the consumption of red meat, and a lot of organizations did not want them to include that recommendation in the dietary guidelines. Your comments?
Yeah, so I think they are not as clear about the original advice from the Dietary Guidelines Committee. This is the committee of scientists that developed the advice that is a good advice to eat less red and processed meat. But even this new guideline that just came out this week does make note of the fact that there's evidence of cancer links related to consumption of processed meat, and that particularly teenage boys and men overconsume red meat and processed meat and would do well for nutritional reasons to cut back that their consumption of burgers and other sources of processed sausages and hot dogs and other sources of red and processed meat. We think that evidence on cancer is very strong. The International Agency for Research on Cancer came out last fall and said that for processed meat, there is a clear link to cancer. from consumption of processed meat, and that it's linear. The more processed meat you eat, the more of a risk of cancer that you have.
So when Dylan here talks about eating his bacon and to hell with the future, he's pretty well looking down the barrel of a shotgun then, isn't he?
Well, I'll say it's a small relative increase in risk. So, you know, the kinds of cancer that are the result of bacon consumption are not common cancers. They're, but at the level of the broad, so I can't say about this individual, you know, I wouldn't condemn him personally. But I would say at the population level, when you look at sort of the whole U.S., if we all decreased our consumption of processed meat, you would see a decrease in the number of those cancers that are related to that bacon consumption and sausage consumption.
Okay, then with respect to this 2015 dietary guidelines, it would seem then that the meat industry has exerted a lot of influence on the panel in order to have their products, meat, not banned or looked down upon or frowned upon by the dietary guidelines. So that would indicate to me that there is significant amount of political pull in the process, and that's what I'd like to ask you about when I get back. Is there not a political and economic influence in the process of establishing these dietary guidelines? Michael Olson here. This is the Food Chain Radio program with Laura McCleary, Regulatory Affairs Director, Center for Science in the Public Interest, and you, 831-479-1080. If you have a question about what we should and should not be eating, well, here's the person to ask. 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Well, eggs are bad. No, no, no. Eggs are good. Bacon is good. No, bacon is bad. Bread is bad? No, bread is good. Butter is good. No, butter is bad. Lots of advice for us out there. Who should we believe? That's the question on the table today. And how did they manage to talk us into eating ourselves into an obesity epidemic in which one in three of us has become obese? Incredible. Gosh, you know what? Come to think about Laura McCleary, who is with the Science in the Public Interest. Has the world ever seen an obesity epidemic like the one we have now?
I think not. And part of it is the widespread availability of highly unhealthy food. And so, you know, when you try to eat healthy, I think you can go out into the world and find very little support for that effort. You go into any convenience store and there's unhealthy snacks and beverages that are loaded with added sugar, and you go to a restaurant and the average meal is over 1,000 calories and loaded with sugars and sodium.
Things that taste good, right?
Hard to eat healthy. They do taste good, and we're biologically attuned to consume sugar and fat. But, you know, that some people have called it the toxic food environment. I think the problem with the idea that it's dietary advice that made us fat is that it's really the food industry, and they benefit from manufactured doubt about dietary advice more than anyone. You know, the fault lies with a food system that that privileges profit and convenience and unhealthy eating over the public health impacts on individuals.
And that takes me back to the question of influence, because those people who make a lot of money selling us this stuff, and they do make a lot of money selling us this. I mean, think about how much money they made selling snack wells on the promise that there's no fat in it. Oh, my goodness. So they make a lot of money, and part of that money they take to Washington, D.C. in big suitcases full of cash with $100 bills sticking out and so full. And they walk into the offices of those who make our decisions for us and say, you know, they plunk that suitcase full of cash on top of the desk and say, you know, vote for us. So how does somebody like you, who doesn't have, I assume you don't have that kind of cash, how do you go into those offices and compete?
Well, you know, it's sometimes not so fine. We did a report in the middle of the summer that we called Congressional Catering, and we looked at the link between the political donors to members of Congress and the members who signed on to letters that were critical of the dietary guidelines restrictions on meat. And we found a direct link between money from meat and the cattle ranchers to the members who signed onto those letters. So I think you're absolutely right that politics plays an enormous role here. I think as a process, the dietary guidelines is about as good as it gets in Washington. That's to say, it's certainly science-based. It's, you know, a democratic and open and accountable process that develops it. But it's not 100% science either, and politics, like with anything, plays a role. I think you can point to the muffling of the eat less meat message. Certainly the food industry hates any advice to eat less of anything, and it's always a big fight to get that done.
You know, in looking at the dietary guidelines, it seems to me that the dietary guidelines for 2015 are really those of Michelle Obama's school lunch program. Am I wrong?
Well, there is certainly a link, because the dietary guidelines from 2010, the last time they issued this kind of advice, was the basis for the school food reform. So it makes sense that given that the advice hasn't changed that much from 5 years ago, that it looks very similar. And that the main function of this advice is to serve as the basis for federal nutrition programs, like mm-hmm. the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance for Families, basically food stamps, and the school foods program.
And that would mean, of course, that there's a lot of money involved if it's a basis for the government food programs, of which there must be at least $100 trillion involved there, huh?
Yeah, there's a lot of money in those government food programs. The idea is that we use that money for good, that is to support public health mm-hmm. and nutrition goals that are grounded in scientific evidence. So I think it makes sense that the guidelines are the foundation or framework for the processes.
So in looking at Michelle Obama's school lunch program, one of the things that is almost universally true about it is that the kids don't want to eat it. And if that's the case in public schools, what good are guidelines that nobody's going to follow? I mean, if we follow in the footsteps of our children and don't eat what's being recommended to us, what good is it?
Well, I'll say a couple things about that. First is, I don't think that the data support the idea that no one's eating it. Hasn't been the food waste that is much heard about when you look at the data. A lot of school districts, most of the school districts in the country, in fact, have adjusted without any difficulty. And we're really reshaping the diet of kids in a fundamental way that's going to have very positive outcomes, both for childhood obesity and diabetes, and also for the future in terms of human suffering and healthcare costs. So I disagree with that verdict about the program. But I also think, you know, in the dietary guidelines and in other places, they're proposing sort of easy substitutions that people can make. So instead of having three slices of bacon at breakfast, have one piece of bacon and some black beans or some other source of protein like cheese. So that you're not exposing yourself to the processed meat. Substitute fresh foods for canned foods because they're lower in sodium. There's easy switches and sort of low-hanging fruit, if you will, that people can make that will dramatically alter their dietary future. And so we're just encouraging folks to make those shifts as they can and to do it incrementally and in the ways that they already like to eat.
So, a little bit of common sense?
A little bit of common sense, that's right.
And then it would seem like there are three really big policy or three big influences as to what we eat here. Of course, there's the government. There's the industry that manufactures foods. And, of course, then there's ourselves, our consumers, our family and friends and associates all telling each other what we should eat. So who do you think is responsible for talking us into this obesity epidemic? That's a question I want to pick up when we get back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson with Laura McCleary. It's clear that we have talked ourselves into an obesity epidemic, but who talked us into it? Is it the government? Is it the industry? Is it ourselves? How did we manage to do this? Phone numbers today, 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. Laura McCleary, who is the Regulatory Affairs Director for the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And you, what do you think? Who did this to us? Was it the government? Was it industry? Was it ourselves? 831-479-1080. Do stay tuned. Right back. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson here with Laura McCleary, Center for the Science and the Public Interest. We're going to go to producer Dylan here, who has a question. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. I was just a little confused about some of your dietary advice, because I'm hearing that processed meats are bad and cause cancer, and also that as Americans we should be cutting down on our sugar intake, but we're also not eating enough fruits, and fruits are really high in sugar. So I was just curious as to, do we know what it is about the processing process that makes meats more cancerous, and also how I could cut down on my sugar intake while also eating more fruits?
Good questions, Laura.
Those are great questions. So first about meats, they're not really sure what it is about meat processing that is linked to the cancer risk. It might be something called nitrosamines, which are a chemical part of meats. That is in, and processed meats have that chemical added to it as part of the processing. So it might be that you're just getting a double dose of the chemical that's in all meat.
Nitrosamines, are those the same as nitrates?
Similar, but chemically distinct. Nitrates are in the same family of chemicals as the amino acids version of nitrosamines. And so they also think it might be having to do with the cooking process. When you barbecue, there's a thing called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, that are created, and those may increase cancer risk. So they think marinating meat and cooking it under low temperatures is probably healthier for red meat and for processed meat both. So that's, you know, they're not really sure what the mechanism of action is that is linked to the cancer risk, but they can see in the data that people who eat more processed meat have a higher risk of these certain kinds of cancers. On fruits, you're right that they are relatively high in sugar, but even the most sweet fruit, or even like raisins or cranberries, doesn't have close to the level of sugar in a soda. And so most of the studies that have been done on sugar levels have been done on sugar-sweetened beverages, which include, you know, the kinds of sugars that you would see in a typical container of soda or cola. And those are very disturbing. Some of the research out of San Francisco shows that 2 weeks of exposure to high fructose corn syrup in levels that are about what you would drink in a soda can lead to metabolic syndrome, which is the precursor for a lot of health problems. So the data show that basically it's impossible to consume enough naturally occurring sugar from whole fruit to pose a risk. And it's really when you have these highly concentrated and especially liquid forms of sugar that you would be concerned. The obvious question is, then what about fruit juice? And the answer is, we don't know. Most of the research has been about added sugars and not about fruit juice, but nutritionists are concerned that the concentrated sugars in liquid form in fruit juice might have similar effects. So the advice is eat whole fruit and eat as many as you like, because you really can't get enough sugar in a whole fruit form to be of any concern.
And a follow-up question to that, the low sugar and the low-calorie diets have spawned a whole industry of sugar alternatives. Have you folks looked at the safety and the efficacy of consuming non-sugar sweeteners like sucralose and all of those things that nobody can pronounce?
Yeah, and we have a resource on our website called Chemical Cuisine, which provides really detailed information about the safety of particular sweeteners. But our advice is to stay away from them. In particular, aspartame, we think, is linked to cancer in three independent studies that were done in animals. And we have concerns about the lack of appropriate and adequate safety testing of some of the other artificial sweeteners. So the government says they're safe. Center for Science and the Public Interest doesn't believe that that's true, and would urge consumers to look into the issues of their favorite sweetener by looking at our website, Chemical Cuisine.
And one other thing with respect to fats that I've always wondered about, I developed a little notion that fats consumption is related to latitude. In that the closer you are to the equator, the easier it is to eat foods that are very low in fats. But I'm wondering about, you know, going to our friends, the Aleuts, who live up at the top of Alaska, and saying, you got to quit eating that whale blubber and live on this arugula.
Well, that's true that there are a range of healthy eating patterns and a range of dietary practices across the world. It's also true that when you look at data that applies to more the general population in the U.S., you can see some pretty clear patterns about the relationship of saturated fat and high sodium levels to disease. And so what the government does with that is they say, look, this is some examples of healthy eating patterns. Here are the targets for these different things that we think should be limited and should be increased. But your job is to figure out, based on your experience of your own body and your current eating patterns, how to make adjustments.
Now, that's exactly where I want to go with our last segment. We have a quick break coming up, but our last segment, I want to ask Laura McCleary from the Center for Science in the Public Interest, what exactly is the responsibility of we consumers in this confusing milieu of information, where eggs are good and eggs are bad and meat is good and meat is bad and this and that? What exactly can we do to find the right way to eat? This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson, Laura McCleary, and you right back. Well, I'm not certain how we got here, but we got here, which is, and here, of course, is a situation where one-third of us are now obese. Break the scales upon which we stand. And it's not good for those who are obese. It's not good for the country. Not good for anybody. How on earth did we get here, given all that we know about food? Who talked us into this? Was it industry who's trying to sell us something? Is it government who's trying to protect somebody? Is it ourselves just not thinking? What do you think, Laura? Who's responsible for us getting where we're at today?
Well, I think people are creatures of their environment. So while we all have choices to make and we go about our lives inside those choices, we also know from research that we're prompted to feel hungry even when we're not hungry by the mere sight of food. And so the fact that food is everywhere when you go to check out of even a, you know, Bed Bath and Beyond is a real problem, because it provides us with an impulse opportunity to overconsume calories that then show up in our waistline. Portion sizes have also increased by a third since the 70s. You know, everyone saw Super Size Me, and it's true. Those have not gone down, even though we're now aware that the Big Gulp keeps getting bigger. And that's unhealthy for all of us as well. When we're presented with bigger portions, every one of us tends to overeat. It's just we take our cues from what we're presented with. That's how we're set up as animals. So I think there's a lot that has to do with our food environment making us sick.
So really,
I think dietary advice could be streamlined. So,
you know, what you say about the ubiquity of food reminds me of my father, who lived on a World War II Navy destroyer, and how precious was ice cream to those sailors in those days because their ship was too small to make it for themselves. They had to beg it from ships that were bigger than the destroyers, like, you know, battleships and whatnot. And so ice cream was a very precious commodity to those tin can sailors. And yet today, ice cream is available on almost every street corner in America. And that it's there everywhere is really tempting. And we're not very good at putting up with the temptation, are we?
That's right. And it's not that there's no place for treating ourselves on occasion. It's just that it's become a daily habit for so much of the U.S. population. And I think, you know, I think you can change your attitude towards that environment, but it's really difficult. When I travel with my family, trying to find healthy options on the road is a challenge. It's a real challenge, and it shouldn't be that way. We should have a food environment that really supports healthy eating, and where fresh fruits and vegetables that are appetizing and in good quality are widely available to everyone. And so, you know, we really need to change a lot about how our constructive food environment provides the choices for us.
Is that possible to change that environment, given the money that's lined up against that eventuality? I mean, nobody's going to make a lot of money selling fresh fruits and vegetables. They're going to make a lot of money selling snack wells.
That's right. It's a challenge. And I think the way that we succeed is to have more and more people becoming food activists by supporting positive changes in their environments. That includes schools and workplaces. We have a handbook for how to have healthy meetings where you get up and stretch and you serve healthy foods. Whether we go to our grocery store and insist on a healthy checkout environment.
And Laura, how do people get in touch with you folks at CSPI?
We're at CSPI.net. And we'd love to have your help.
And there it is. We're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us, Laura McCleary, Center for Science and Public Interest. And thank you all for joining. Remember, Michael Olson's Third Law of the Food Chain, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live. KSCO, Santa Cruz.